Hi, Rich Shea again with another Play Board Games Better podcast. This one's the second in my series with Rob Kircher on how to organize and run tournament play. So thanks for tuning in and listening, and I hope you'll find this useful.
Before we get started with today's podcast, I'd like to tell you that more than others, it's about files. So on the website, playboardgamesbetter.com, on this podcast page, I've posted a number of example files that are there. You can inspect some that I point to, the ones I posted on the page. Feel free to use, make modifications, and frankly, send me criticisms and ideas for improvements. Thanks. Let's start the podcast right now.
Say hi, Rob.
Hello, everyone.
All right. Unfortunately, today's subject is the boring part.
Very dry.
Yeah. In order to run a tournament, there's some administrative stuff that you really have to do. And if you get it wrong, you're going to annoy everybody. And if you get it right, nobody's going to notice that you did it right. Sorry, but you have to do it right. Yeah, it's all about keeping records. Pretty good records. Maybe not absolutely perfect, but still pretty good.
Will hopefully save you some headaches down the line.
So the very first thing is signing up the people who are in the tournament. Typically, people use a sign-up sheet. I'll post an example of one on the website to look at, but basically the important things to record are name, a badge number if you're at an organized event, or at least the unique identifier to make sure like people with the same name as their children don't get confused. Right? That can be a little tricky. If there's multiple heats, it's best to have a sign-up sheet with a column for each heat so people's names aren't on the list twice, but you know how many times they played. That's pretty much what you need on the sign-up sheet. Make sure it's legible. The WBC people insist that the official sign-up sheet is filled out by the GM, not by the players.
So use a separate sheet to sign people in,
yeah.
And then later on for the official record-keeping, you then fill in the official sheets.
There, but that's just their way to do it based on how things can go wrong if you just let people sign themselves in. Just a warning, you don't have to do it that way, but I think a painful set of lessons, that's how they learn to do it. Next, after you've signed everybody in, it's time to set up the games and the tables. The first thing that means is number or identify the separate tables. If you want to be really fancy, you'll actually have a number for each table. And that way you can tell people to go to different numbered tables. Less fancy, we're going to talk about how to randomly assign people to tables using playing cards. And each table is identified by a playing card that the owner of the game is holding. So you have to be a little careful about that. So let's talk about this. You could make up the assignments, and in later rounds you might and assign people to specific tables, but typically there's some kind of randomization. And what could be more random than a pack of playing cards? Well, maybe dice, but there's a problem with dice. Remember, each playing card in a deck is unique. If you want to, you can use, if your tournament's really big, you could have two decks of cards with different colored blacks. I have a red back and a blue back deck for Puerto Rico. It can get kind of large. I mean, 130 people played total in the tournament before, although it was in several heats. But I did end up using more than one deck of cards at a time once. So what you do is, and we talked about this earlier, usually, except for later rounds, you let the owner of a game sit with their game at a table. So let's say you have your deck, you have the four aces. Maybe you'll give the ace of spades to the owner of the game, tell them to go find a table, they're the ace of spades. If you want to be super organized, you'll like line them up so that the two is near the ace and the three is after the two. But sometimes it's like herding cats. Then take the other three cards and put them in the deck you're going to shuffle together and let the players who don't have games assigned to tables select from to see what table they go to. I think that's pretty clear. Is that clear, Rob?
That's pretty clear. Deck of cards, of course, works great for four players and less. If you have a game that's a five-player game, then you kind of have to make up your own customized set of cards. You can either use 3x5 index cards, work very good for, and you just number them. You start them off with table one. You make up to however many seats you need. and table two and so forth. I used a Excel spreadsheet and I made a set of cards on business card size, cut them out and then put them in card sleeves. So then I had table numbers of 1 to 5 for up to 16 tables. So that's how I have it set up for my tournament.
But it's important to have a consistent way of assigning people to the tables. After people get to the tables, it's possible that seating order matters and you want to randomize it. And frankly, they can just use the 4 cards or the 5 cards, shuffle them up and, you know, deal them out. You can use bridge suit style. What's that? Spade is 1, heart
Spade,
2,
heart,
diamond,
club.
And club. I didn't even play bridge and I remembered that. That's just seats 1, 2, 3, and 4. You might have other ways of assigning seating at the table, and we'll talk about that a little later in the podcast. So now you've got everybody signed in, you've got everybody sitting down, and they're ready to play the game. But wait, you need another piece of paper.
You need score sheets
for each table.
So you want to hand out the score sheets to each table, and to help with your record keeping, you probably want to go ahead and pre-fill out the heat or round that you're playing in and the table that you assign the score sheet to. That'll save you from having to guess who is who afterwards.
Then ask everybody to sign in on the sheet, again, repeating their name legibly and their badge number. And we'll have on the website a typical sheet so you can see what they look like. And feel free to copy and make your own changes, and it'll be a PDF file, I think, or maybe even an Excel spreadsheet. And emphasize that you need people to fill it out legibly or they won't get credit for playing. Be kind of harsh about that. Gamers are good. They want credit for playing, especially winning, so they'll probably comply. And when you're making up the sheet, remember, leave a space for the score.
And also when you design your score sheet, keep in mind for any kind of tiebreakers that you use. So you want to have that as available information for the players to record. So that way you can always go back and make sure that everything was recorded properly.
Now you can let people play. And hey, feel free to play yourself, because usually this is the quietest time. Occasionally there'll be a rules question. People will come to you. And hopefully you know the game well enough so that it won't result in a debate. But remember, if things are unclear, you're the GM. How you interpret the rules is how it's interpreted at that moment. There aren't any instant replay cameras or anything else. It's all on you. Now, one thing that's important to understand is, if you're playing in a tournament, you need somebody to be a judge about rules if it's your table that's involved. Because people will perceive, of course, that you're going to look out for number one. That would be you. Despite all the trouble and effort you went to set up this tournament, they're still going to think that you're looking out for yourself, not them. So have an assistant GM, somebody appointed or volunteered at another table that you feel is knowledgeable about the game and that you asked, who will come over if there's a problem at your table and make a ruling. Now, if the problem at your table is that somebody's being a jerk, you're still the GM. Feel free to deal with it any way you want. But for rules questions, it's good to get an outside, unbiased person, so probably not your spouse. Unfortunately, it'll probably be somebody you've gamed with before, but that's as good as it gets. Now you've finished up the game, hopefully, because at tournaments, there's time slots, and so you might have to end a game just before the time limit and adjudicate. We'll talk about that later. It's ugly, you don't want to have it happen, so pick a comfortable time period for the game to run in.
And just remember to give your players warnings. We got 30 minutes to go, we got 15 minutes to go. So that way they can kind of plan their moves accordingly, or hopefully the slow player might speed up his play a little bit.
Did I tell you when you're the GM you have to use your outside voice? I don't usually use my outside voice very much. But when I'm running a tournament, I use my outside voice. It's just the way it goes. Okay, the games are all over. Now, make sure that everybody has properly and legibly filled out the sheets, recording the scores. You'd be surprised how much in a hurry people are to get out of there after the game's over. And they want to clean up the game and other stuff. But they'll get in the habit when they've done some tournament play. Make sure that they know they're supposed to return the sheets to you, not leave them somewhere. You don't want to lose track of the sheets. Nothing's more embarrassing than not being able to figure out what actually happened. So you've collected the sheets, the players have gone on to their next event, and you either save the sheets till the end of the day or immediately deal with them, and it's time to figure out who's where, and that means copying all the data off the sheets that were handwritten into a spreadsheet, if you're lucky. I mean, you can do all the calculations by hand, but Lord, it's the 21st century. You have spreadsheets. If you don't, you can get the Google spreadsheet for free. So go for it.
And especially when you have tournaments of less than 10 or 15 people. Okay, yeah, doing it by hand might be the most practical method. But when you're dealing with tournaments of 20 and more or 50 or 100, a spreadsheet becomes a necessity to save you an awful lot of time.
And also, if the spreadsheet's designed correctly, it will do the math correctly every time, which might not be something you can say for yourself at, say, 1 in the morning after a long day of gaming.
Which also means when you design your if you do design your own spreadsheet, do test the spreadsheet out before the tournament and test it with some real results so that way you can make sure that it's calculating properly.
I'll have an example spreadsheet for Puerto Rico. It's relatively sophisticated to handle multi-rounds and stuff, but it'll give you a good idea of what's going on. And if you're somewhat spreadsheet savvy, you can modify it and read stuff. And hey, if you find a problem with it, let me know. That's really important. And a piece of advice, do stay up to date on the record keeping as much as you can. Don't fall behind, because if you end up with a giant pile of papers, you haven't entered any of the rounds, it's time to figure out who the finalists are, you'll feel pressured. But if you get a chance to enter the data after each round, you'll do it in little bite-sized pieces.
And your players will also appreciate if you do your record keeping sooner rather than later and post the standings, so that way they can be informed as to where they are and how they need to play each round.
Another reason for using the spreadsheets is once you get the data in, of course, it should be able to just pop out the report of standings for you, and you can print it out and paste it up. Of course, that means that the event you have gives you access to a printer, which is possible. As you get further into the 21st century, of course, you'll send a copy of the file. It'll be projected on the wall, right? We're almost there, Rob.
We're getting there.
At TotalCon and WBC and EuroQuest, the GMs print out the results as soon as they can, and they post them before the next round occurs, almost always.
Yep, okay? They post the standings on the kiosks. They're usually provided for each individual game, or they'll have a bulletin board to place the standings, overall standings for chairman of the boards and other type wild card standings. Sometimes will be projected up on a projector on the wall to let everyone know where they are.
And that's true. Not every place has the kiosk, but the WBC kiosks are great. I think in a later one and on the website, I'll take some photos and put them up so you can see how they work. It's a very neat idea. Requires a lot of effort. At WBC, they make up a kiosk and then they keep it for 15 years, so I guess they get good return on the effort. For smaller venues, I'm not sure it's worth it, but they are kind of cool. Once you've done all the rounds, you have to figure out the seeding and the arrangements for the semifinals or finals. Unfortunately, you can't always count on everybody showing up who's qualified. So what you have to do is you have to rank a bunch of players. So let's say that you are running a pretty big event, and you're going to have four tables, 16 people in the semifinal, and then you're going to have a four-player final after that, right? I did that right. Right, Rob?
That's right, Matthew.
All right. The probability that all 16 people who qualify are going to be able to make it, I mean, their favorite game might be going on at the same time, maybe they had to go home, maybe they just overslept. You're going to have to rank, after those 16 people, probably I'd rank everybody else, and eight more people, and have people understand that if you're near the 16th person, but not the 16th person, come over and take a look if you're interested. You may qualify for the semifinal because people don't make it. And you have to be ready to sort the people that way. You can wait a couple of extra minutes, but remember, don't wait too long for missing people. If they're 5 minutes late, they're late. They should have known. I mean, it's a schedule. There's times. Everybody has a digital watch or timekeeper of some kind. Heck, everybody's carrying this thing with an alarm system on it. My phone will tell me what time it is. It's my problem when I miss an event, really. Have the rankings down to where you can fill up enough seats to make what you want.
And then have some alternates to fill in afterwards, because like you said, everyone doesn't always show up. And that's especially if you have your events are run at different times, where you have your rounds and then you have your semifinals. If you're running your heat, your event continuous, you probably won't have as much of a problem, but you still want to have rankings because, once again, people might want to drop out, go to a different game. So you always want to be flexible and be prepared for different numbers that are available.
Including having how to decide which tables are different size tables. People have a preferred number for many events, and you can't blame them. They're most used to that, and they think the game plays better that way. It might or might not work out. Just make sure you have rules for it. The other thing is, once we're past the opening rounds, you might not want to have completely random table assignments. There's a bunch of different ways to look at it. The harsher way is to have all the good players, the best players with the best records, at the same table. I think it's a little cruel myself to do that, because it gives an advantage to the players who weren't doing as well, or you could think that they were just being lucky. The other way to do it is to spread out the good players, and let's say there's 16 again, the top four people are in different tables, the next four are at different tables, and so on. You could do that. I think in some ways that's a little fairer. People could argue. Rob might argue. What do you think, Rob?
I've seen both that work well. You just... where one system, you just take all your players, you seed them 1 to 16, and then assign them to tables. Another hybrid method is that if you have multiple winners, or if you have one that kind of separates themselves, to have them separate at separate tables, and then everyone with at least a win then randomized to the other tables. That's probably the system I use most often. But you can still go with a completely random system, depending on the game and whether you want to how you want to reward play through the heats.
Just remember, make sure it's spelled out ahead of time in your write-up on how you're going to run the tournament, and that way there can't be any real arguments. People can discuss whether you should do it next time or not, but they can't argue with you then. When you get to the finals table, of course, now the question becomes, how do you want to do the seeding? For a lot of games, you can make it completely random. But there are some games, and I'm afraid Puerto Rico, the tournament I run, is maybe the worst-case scenario, where everybody understands, and the statistics are pretty strong, that playing the rules as written gives one seat, oddly enough the third seat in Puerto Rico, a statistically significant advantage over the other players. So what we've done in Puerto Rico is instituted a bidding system for seat order. If you look at the Puerto Rico game write-up on the WBC that I did, you'll see complete instructions for how to do that. And I even created a, I think, rather nice-looking little board for doing the bidding on. And if it's an issue, you could do it that way. Otherwise, you have to do really random seeding. As long as everybody agrees that it's fair, well, you're the GM, as long as you think it's fair, do ask some opinions. Last year I asked, well, people say that in Puerto Rico, for instance, you can make a minor adjustment. The third and fourth seats each give up a coin. And as near as anybody can tell from a fair amount of testing, now all the seats have an equally valid chance. I talked about that with some top players in both the game and, frankly, sharks at a lot of games. And the consensus was, no, leave the bidding in place. You don't want to confuse people and you don't want to start a fight. And everybody knows exactly what the bidding's like, even though, in my experience, people don't bid high enough for the third seat. But they're learning. Those are things to think about with that. Those are all administrative things. Keep good records. And if you automate, remember, if you're going to be running the tournament again in the future, and I hope you will once you do it, once you invest the time and effort into learning to be a GM, and it'll seem really annoying the first time, second and subsequent times are much easier. I'll have to say that it would have been a nightmare to run the Puerto Rico tournament without some tournament GMing experience, but my GMing experience was no preparation for the size of that tournament. But with some help from some friends, the second year was about half the amount of work, frankly, once I figured things out. And if you're running a big tournament, get some help with the paperwork. I had, actually, the first year I ran, I had amazing help. Lexi came over and just did paperwork, even though she wasn't in the tournament for that round. Just somebody came over and helped me sign people in the whole time and then went on to whatever she was doing.
Yeah, especially if you have large tournaments, or if you have a large number of players, you definitely don't want to be the one signing people in if you can have an assistant to sign your players in. So that way, that'll free you up to start working on how many boards you need to have set up and the kind of directing people as to where they can go. And you'll almost certainly have someone that'll start asking you questions at the last minute. So as much as you can keep yourself freed up there, especially for a larger tournament, it's definitely recommended.
So one other administrative task I didn't talk about that might come before all of them, especially in Puerto Rico, because it has a reputation for shark-like play, I address the crowd. I tell them my expectations for fair play, good behavior, and that it's supposed to be fun. I make it very clear that I'm the GM, and if you try to make a mess out of my tournament with your bad behavior, I'm happy to throw you out. And happily, by addressing the crowd ahead of time, I've never had to do that. It's amazing how people respond when you tell them exactly what's expected of them. And that's why we're telling you this about being a GM. Because once you know what's expected of you as a GM, I'm sure you'll be able to do it if you want. And with a little experience.
And make it a whole lot easier.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to our rambling about that. And we'll be back with more on this next time. I think what we're going to be talking about is ties, rule clarifications, a little more on time limits, and did you know sometimes people will cheat to win a tournament? Yeah, it's amazing. Even when there's no prize. Yeah, I was shocked too, but it happens. Very, very rare. But like everything in life, if you're prepared to deal with it ahead of time, you'll be able to deal with it a lot better. So that concludes this part. But again, I thought I'd annoy Rob with games. Today we played Nations, the dice game. I played a demo at Origins, and Rob had picked it up and played it. Was this the first time?
No, this would be the third time
The third time we played it. If you like Nations, but it goes on a little long for you, I think you're going to like Nations, the dice game. If you don't like Nations a whole lot, you're going to like the dice game better than Nations. It's a pretty good game. Some very interesting decisions. I think you have to look more at what you think the other players are going to do than a lot of other games.
Well, just like in Nations, you do have to worry about like what tiles are available. So you do look at what they have for dice that they have available to see what they can buy. And then you might be able to delay your most important thing you have to do because someone else might be able to steal something.
You might be able to calculate that you have time to do something else first. One of the things that's important in the game is being able to re-roll your dice. But that's your action. After the re-roll, you don't get to spend them. You got to wait till it comes around to you again. And after you see somebody re-roll, you suddenly realize, uh-oh, now they're going to grab that tile. Then it's time for you to grab it. But if you stare at their dice and they just don't have it, or you don't think they want to spend extra dice to get it, then maybe you'll wait. So that was extremely interesting. It was also a very close game.
Yeah, we only had 3 points from first to third, and just a one bad die roll was really the difference between last and first.
Yep, and I think actually at the end of the end of the first round, we were all within 2 points.
The end of the third round before final scoring, we were actually all tied together before doing our tile scoring.
And that was halfway through the game. We were all tied up. So, very close game. You have to play pretty carefully, but because it's dice and re-rolling, sometimes you just have to roll the dice. So it was fun. Next we played Elysium, which Rob hadn't played before. Joel played with us. He's gone home. I played the demo at Origins, and I really liked it, so I picked it up right away. I was hardly at all incentivized by the free play mat. Well, maybe I was.
I had some nice look to the game.
And a lot of people said that they compared it to Deus, which is also a very good game. I didn't see the resemblance, except for some theme about pagan gods. Other than that, there wasn't that much resemblance to me. There were cards and money, but that was really about it. In Elysium, you basically, everybody gets to draft the same number of cards from the market, and then you have to draft your turn order marker for next turn. When you draft a card, it goes into your field, and all cards have a special ability, which might or might not be useful. And they stack, and they combine, and sometimes they magnify each other. But the cards themselves don't really score big points until you send them to Elysium, i.e. Hades, by moving them under. But once they're there in the scoring area, the special actions don't do anything for you anymore. So you have to be really, really careful. And you're going to be limited on how many cards you get to move down during the course of the game. It's so many per round, and it can be kind of limited. So there's a lot of really tight decisions. The first few moves were pretty slow as we stared at the interactions to see what was going on.
Yeah, looking for card combinations, because especially early in the game, it's not very clear as to what cards will work well together. And even when you play out the entire game, you really only go through about half the deck. So if you're hoping for a particular card, you might not see it. Or if you mess up on the turn order, someone might grab that card before you get a chance to play it.
A lot of the cards have duplicate cards in it, but you're not going to see them all. And you can't count on the unique cards in each set showing up. I don't want to give a complete review, but I like the game a lot. It was my favorite from Origins, and I got to try a lot of demos there. Well, that's probably enough newsy stuff for now. We'll give you more next time when I get a chance to play some more games, hopefully this Saturday, down in Providence. We'll try some other stuff. And I think that's enough for now, but if it's not, then I won't say this on the actual podcast, and I'll fill it out with some other stuff about funny things that happened in Origins. Thanks for listening, and tune in again soon as I try to make this a more regular series of podcasts. Once we're done talking about how to run games, I think I have to get back to my Puerto Rico series. Maybe I'll try to find some more co-hosts, too. Maybe I can get Rob to do this all the time. Bye for now. Say bye, Rob.
Bye, Rob.